Well, you hear these themes, you know it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here. I'm your overnight dude till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and my buddy the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Monday. That means my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's jokey time. That's coming up later. And we, in honor of yesterday being Father's Day, we are going to talk about the best and worst and most memorable TV and movie dads. We always love to have a little fun doing that. We did it on Mother's Day, and we'll do it in honor of yesterday's fantastic Father's Day. We will talk about the best and worst and most memorable dads in TV and movies and literature, everything. All right? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can talk or text us, 312-981-7200. The movie reviews with Colin Suter and Eric Childress from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more. We do it every week, and let's welcome the guys back to the show. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello there.
All right. Before we get into the movies, what is this? Can you believe this Anton Yelchin thing?
No. No. I crazy.
It's insane. I thought it was a joke. You know, I just thought, okay, that can't be real. But boy, what a sad story. 27 years old. Weird freak car accident. I remember the story, when Green Room came out about how that, because Green Room came out the day after Prince died. And there is that Prince reference in the movie that got spontaneous applause at the screening that I saw it at and across the nation. And now that's going to even be weirder, what? And they got the Star Trek movie coming out. I don't know. And there have been things that I love that guy in, and Green Room being number one. I think Green Room might be the best thing he's ever done. But man, that's sad. It's really, really sad. Did you guys hear about it? I mean, did you hear about it yesterday in the morning or something?
This morning?
Yeah.
No, I didn't hear about it till this afternoon. Someone had actually sent me a message on Facebook, and it was cryptic, and I didn't understand what he was saying at first, and then it took a couple sentences before he went this happened.
Yeah.
So wow. it was a weird kind of shock for me.
Yeah, very strange. Very, very strange. Such a tragedy. 27 years old. Anyway. Did he have anything in the can outside of the Star Trek movie? Does anybody know?
He's got a lot of movies that are in post production or are completed. The Star Trek movie being one of them. Porto as a film, as the last film that's on his IMDb page is something called Thoroughbred, which is in post-production right now.
Okay.
So it doesn't look like he died while something was in production.
Right. So there are a few more of his films that will be released then.
It looks like.
Okay. All right. Well, we've got some movies to talk about this weekend. We got box office as well. Hey, that Finding Dory made a little money.
Made us some amazing cash.
Yeah, made a little money. Yeah. so we'll talk about box office a little bit later on. But let's get into the movie reviews. We got a few of them to review this week. And by the way, Eric, I know that we got movies to talk about next week, but I noticed because we send Eric and Colin send out an email to me and to Dan with a list of the movies and which ones they've seen so that we know which ones are all covered. And I noticed that you saw Tickled.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Colin and I, we saw each other at De Palma Friday night at the Music Box, and they showed a trailer for it. And Colin, is it not like one of the most intriguing trailers for a documentary?
So intrigued. I can't wait.
And you've seen it, Eric. Did you see it at a film fest?
No, I got a screener for it just a few weeks ago.
Yeah,
actually, it played at Sundance. There's a whole bunch of stories and stuff that that go with what this movie's actually about.
Yeah,
I knew very. I mean, when I saw it on the schedule at Sundance, all it basically said was this guy that investigates these tickle videos. I'm like, well, that doesn't sound interesting at all,
right?
To me, and then the more I found out about it, I'm like, oh. Okay.
Yeah. Well,
that's a little more interesting.
The trailer's fantastic. Have you seen the trailer, Eric? I know you've seen the movie. The trailer's great. Colin, you can attest to that.
Yeah. It just makes you want to watch it right now.
Immediately. Everybody in the theater, when the trailer was over, was like, well, geez, man, I wish it was the movie we were going to see.
now. So anyway, but I'm looking forward to that because I'm assuming it's just going to be at the Music Box. I don't see it getting a wide.
I believe so. Yes.
And does anybody know where the Neon Demon is going to open?
Landmark, I think.
Okay. All right. Because I'm excited about it, despite the fact that I hated his last movie.
It's actually going, I've been told it's going sort of semi-wide.
Oh, okay.
So it might be popped up at like the River East and a few other theaters downtown. It's going like 1,000 screens.
I had heard that it was like, this, by the way, it's the guy who directed Drive and his last movie. What was it called? God Kills? Only
God Forgives.
Yeah. But I've read several things where they compare this film to Argento, and that's kind of enough for me.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it. All right, let's talk about Eric, why don't you tell us about Raiders, the story of the greatest fan film ever made, which they played at Music Box yesterday with the guys there, and then they showed the film, their fan film afterwards.
Right, right. Well, this is a film that we played at our festival last year, just as it was coming, starting to make the rounds on the festival circuit, and it's the documentary, it's a story about... You may have heard, from years ago that there were these three young boys who were doing a shot-for-shot remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Right.
Just using, whatever they, all the props that they had, any locations, whatever money they had, to basically just, put this thing together. And they spent their summers and all their free time, crafting these elaborate sequences. And putting this document, this version together, and it became this sort of cult thing over time. I remember getting emails about it from like the people who were handling or like putting the original film together and stuff. And it ended up playing at some, I think it played at like first play like the Buttonomathon in Austin, which plays every December. And they played so much of it, and they actually played it before the Two Towers was going to premiere. And when they had to shut the movie off to start the Two Towers, everyone booed.
that's
the story that our friend Steve Procopi tells us.
That's great.
But this documentary is now takes place in current times, where the boys are getting back together now full grown adults. Are getting back together to basically complete this this remake that they've done. They have one big sequence that they have to do, and of course, it's one of the most elaborate sequences in the film. It's the big plane fight sequence,
right.
Which is fantastic.
Right.
And so the movie takes us through how they set this thing up, and we obviously see a lot of footage from the finished film, mostly finished film. But then the movie actually takes some really interesting turns. We learn, some of the history and a lot of things that happened to these guys from the period when they were, prepubescent teenagers to, what has happened to them in their lives since then. And that stuff's really fascinating. Meanwhile, we're cutting in between the couple days that they've, taken off of work and put money together to actually film this big sequence. So we go back and forth between that, and it's such an entertaining ride. We got a couple movies on the show we're talking about for film lovers this week, and this is absolutely one of them that I hope people do get out to the Music Box if you haven't seen it already, and check this thing out because it's so much fun. It's actually kind of a dark documentary as well as being incredibly joyful at times. It's just a wonderful mix of the two. It's really nicely put together, and two things just towards the end of the film. One, it has one of the biggest jump scares I've had in the theater in some time.
Exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's just, it's fantastic. And then if you stay through the end credits, you see what these guys actually did to complete their movie, and that stuff is just high entertainment of the tallest order. This is a really high recommendation for this film. It's a lot of fun. Go see it at the Music Box while you can.
Okay, and Colin, tell us what you think.
Yeah, I echo everything Eric said. I remember when I watched the screener about a year and a half ago, whenever that was. At first, in the first about half hour, I was kind of like, well, this is stupid. I mean, not the documentary, but the idea of what these guys were doing. And I wasn't really quite on their side for finishing it. You know, I was just kind of like, well, why would I want to watch your adaptation if I could watch the real thing? You know, I had a hard time kind of getting on board with this whole endeavor. But then I just kind of slowly, the movie does a really good job of just sort of winning you over in terms of making you care about these guys and making you want to finish, you want them to finish the adaptation. By the end, you're kind of on the edge of your seat going, God, I hope this goes well. and so I think that's a pretty remarkable accomplishment for a film about fandoms. And you know, the ridiculous ways in which people express their fandom, sort of goofy, over the top, sort of, you know, naive childishness that these guys had, was become something endearing instead of something, you know, annoying. This is a really terrific film about being a fan, and not just being a fan, but having friends who share in that fandom and who have the same kind of crazy ambition that you do. This is highly recommended. The Music Box played the adaptation today, but they're not, doesn't look like they're playing it for, you know, the rest of the week. But I'm sure it's probably out there somewhere, or will be out there as maybe a DVD extra or something. It runs 100 minutes, so I don't know how they, you know, managed to do everything in it, but it does make you want to see the whole thing, strangely enough.
Yeah,
so it's highly recommended.
We've got a break here, but I want to mention it's also streaming. That's how I watched it.
Okay,
it's available on Amazon. It's available on, I have this other streaming thing, VUVA or something. I have it. It's now an app I have. I don't know, but that's how I watched it. I don't even know the name of it, but it's streaming online. You can see it online. If you can't get out to the Music Box, you can see it. There's a way to see it at home. All right, everybody, hang on. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. I'm your overnight dude, 2 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. Steve Grzanich at 5 with the opening bell. Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us there with over 12,000 other fans. And it's updated. It's constantly being it's constantly alive while the show is happening. So check it out, facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is Monday morning. That means my dad will tell a joke a little bit later on. And in honor of yesterday being Father's Day, a little bit later on, we are going to jump into the topic of best and most memorable TV movie dads, literature dads, all that cool stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Right now, though, back to the movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter joined me, and before the break, Eric told us all about Raiders, the documentary, the story of the greatest fan film ever made. It is showing at the Music Box, but it's also streaming online as well. Guys, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And that's what it's about, you guys. I mean, it is about fandom. It is. I mean, that's what the core of this movie is about. And I think movie lovers who have really passionate feelings about certain movies or certain pieces of art will really get into this movie. Don't you guys think? I mean, that's what it's about. The three of us here are very passionate about a lot of movies, passionate to the point where, like, you see them over and over and over again, and they mean a lot to you, and that's what this thing is. I was pretty much with him from the beginning, though, Colin. Eric, were you?
Oh, yeah.
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 I was like, okay, I think these guys are cool. I think it's funny, and I was definitely rooting for him, without question. And some of the stuff, it's pretty remarkable what these kids did, and how ingenious some of the stuff they did to get some of this stuff made is pretty remarkable and actually inspiring. And I like these guys. I would have liked to have met them yesterday at the. Have you guys met them? Did they come in for the movie?
No, but one of their dad's parents did.
Oh, is that right?
They live here in Chicago, and they came. We played the movie opening night last year, and so they had some friends and family that were here.
Okay, very, very cool. Now, have either of you, you haven't seen their movie, have you?
No.
No, I haven't seen it. I want to see it, though, now.
Right.
I really do. I so want to see it. And I would guess that when this thing comes out on DVD, they'd have to include it, wouldn't you think?
I think there are rights issues.
Oh.
One of the main reasons why the film hasn't been played very often.
Mm.
Yeah, even though, like, I mean, Spielberg, you know, eventually endorsed what they did.
Right, yeah, right.
There are, I think, there's the with music and all the kind of stuff that they use in the film, that there are, I don't know, some legal rights or something that they can't show it in any kind of regular engagement, I think.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's too bad. Maybe, you know, like at some point it'll be screened again. And but we had a chance yesterday. I couldn't do it. But anyway, Raiders, the story of the greatest fan film ever made, is playing at the Music Box, and it is streaming online, and you can see it at home. That's how I saw it. Very, very, very entertaining and really, really, really good documentary. All right. Well, let's get the other documentary about movies underway here. Colin, tell us about De Palma.
Yeah, well, this will be the easiest description of a film ever. So this is a documentary about Brian De Palma, made by Noam Baumbach and Jake Paltrow, and which is kind of a strange idea coming from those two directors, but I guess makes a little more sense when you see the film because the approach to it is very low-key. It's basically just Brian De Palma himself talking for what, 90 minutes,
2 hours,
minutes?
2 hours, yeah.
2 hours.
Yeah. It's like 3 minutes. I think it's wait, I'll look up the running time right now. It's an hour 47, so it sounds like an hour and 50 minutes.
So, if you got a guy like that and the movie is just him talking, he better be a good talker. You know, Brian De Palma is a good talker. He's full of great stories and full of great insight about movies and filmmaking and his particular approach. And that's basically what you get. You get basically a nice hour and 47-minute film school lesson from one of the greats. You know, this is the guy who made Carrie and Dressed to Kill and Blowout and Scarface, The Untouchables, you know, Mission Impossible, Carlito's Way, Body Double, a lot of amazing films. You know, he came up with Spielberg and George Lucas and Francis Coppola, and, I mean, he was in that group, Scorsese. You know, these guys all went to school together, and they all came up together at the same time, and they're just part of one of those great film revolutions, you know, that'll never happen again. You just sit and listen to this guy tell stories, you know, give his opinion on films of today or, you know, films of yesteryear, and that's pretty much it. And, you know, again, we're talking about another kind of fan film. This is a film for people who really already kind of know De Palma's work, or at least, you know, have great familiarity with it. If you have only seen maybe 2 or 3 De Palma films, you might not get that much out of it. At least that was the impression I got from a couple people that I knew who went and saw it on Friday night. They were, you know, just sort of not quite, you know, well-versed in his filmography, but had seen a couple of the films, and they weren't exactly, you know, on board with seeing more by the time it was over. So I was like, okay, well, it's not really going to make the case for somebody who's not a fan. But for somebody who is a fan, so for people who know their film history and know, you know, a lot about, you know, the visual language of film, this is going to be a really interesting lesson and, you know, just kind of a treat for people who, you know, love Brian De Palma. You know, there's no other actor or a director makes any insight in the film. It's just De Palma. That's all you're going to get. And that's fine, because I was just thoroughly entertained from beginning to end. Hour and 47 minutes, it flew by really fast. And when it was over, I was kind of taken aback going, oh, we're done? Oh, he was just going on a train of thought that I was really interested in hearing more about. So I thought, you know, the low-key approach, the very straightforward approach worked for me. And so I recommend it if you are fans of De Palma or know his work well enough to, you know, want to know more about it. It's all about being a film fan this week at the Music Box.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Eric?
Yeah, Colin made a very important distinction there, basically between the two films we just talked about. Raiders, obviously, a film being for film fans, and De Palma certainly is for that, but it is specifically for fans of De Palma films, or at least people familiar with Brian De Palma's work, is because it's basically, you know, take it what you will, it's De Palma having a conversation with you, not even so much an audience. It's, you know, he's talking straight to you. There's no, you know, Paltrow and Bombeck aren't, you don't hear them on the soundtrack asking questions. It's just him talking about his work throughout the entire career. And then the way I've been describing it to people is that I've been saying that basically my impression of the film is that it's both the best and the worst episode of Inside the Actor's Studio you've ever seen. Best in that it covers the entire career. And like Colin said, you know, there are many entertaining stories here, and there's a lot of stuff that's a lot of fun to watch. And it feels kind of like the chapter one of like a new documentary series in a way, you know, in the way that, you know, Robert Rodriguez had that director show where he would have people on and they'd talk about a portion of their career and whatnot. It feels like that, only much better, but, you know, a much greater length. And, you know, to see a director talk about his entire career like that is really fascinating and hypnotic and very watchable. But at the same time, there are things that, you know, as the filmmaker side, that, you know, and maybe maybe the stuff is on the cutting room floor. Maybe De Palma didn't want to talk about it too much. There's the only sort of, I think, scratch the surface of some of the things that of a lot of the criticisms of De Palma, the misogyny, the luring gaze at women, the violence towards women, and particularly the way he liberates very freely from Mr. Hitchcock. Though I do think that starting the film off with images from Vertigo and him talking about what that movie means to him is a very important thing that sort of just sort of permeates through over the entire film, which I thought was a smart choice. So it's like if you're going in there to find out a lot of stuff that you don't already know about De Palma from either other interviews or things that have been written about him in the past, you're really not going to find that. If you want to just go see a film about a really terrific filmmaker who is going to talk to you for almost 2 hours straight about his entire career, you're gonna have a very good time with the film.
Okay, we got a break, and I'll give you my review after we take a break here. We're talking about the movie De Palma, which is a documentary about Brian De Palma and his work that is now playing at the Music Box. And I'll give you my thoughts on it right after we take a break here. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And those themes means that it's obviously the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more always join me and talk about the new movies. Eric and Colin, welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
All right, we were just talking about the documentary De Palma, which both Eric and Colin enjoyed. Let me just say this for people who might not be regular listeners. I kind of like Brian De Palma. just a little.
So no. The documentary convinced you.
That's what it was. Okay. I was on the fence till I saw the movie. In all seriousness, Brian De Palma is one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. He's made some of my favorite movies of all time. I love his work. I love him. I think he's a master, an absolute master. So, I will say this, Eric, I totally agree with you. This movie is made specifically for people like me. And I don't, honest to God, I don't know. And I told you this, Colin, when it ended, because Colin and I saw this together Friday night. When it ended, I was like, I don't know how this is going to, you know, how people who are just have a cursory knowledge of his work or kind of like a few of his movies are gonna enjoy this. I don't see people who aren't fanatical about Brian De Palma enjoying this movie that much. Now, having said that, being one of those fanatics, I loved every second of this movie. I thought it was absolutely great. And I think, you know, Eric, I think the Hitchcock stuff and the misogyny is talked about. And covered.
Talked about it, but it's the same old things that we've heard before.
Well, I don't know about that.
For maybe a little bit more.
Well, I don't know.
Just something a little bit more from the man himself.
Well, no, I think both things are taken. Well, the one. Okay, let me start with the Hitchcock thing. The Hitchcock thing to me is absolutely confronted in the film, where he says that he was the only one who was taking the techniques that Hitchcock originated, and went with them. And, you know, like he talks about how Hitchcock invented a brand new language of film, which is absolutely true. And he was the only one who really took that and ran with it and tried to take these techniques that were obviously Hitchcock invented and use them. And I think he talks about it, and I think he does it honestly, and I think it's insightful. The misogyny thing, okay, that comes out a few times in the movie. My favorite being, because I just don't think, it seemed to me like while watching this movie that De Palma's thought process is different than many humans. That's just the impression I got. And I've always felt that way about his work. I'm like, well, what? You know, I've always felt he's one of the ballsiest filmmakers that's ever made movies and he's completely unapologetic about it. And in the movie, he just seems to be on a different, he's a guy that seems to be on a different planet sometimes, like his thought process. Like, for instance, they show the amazing sequence from Body Double, where the guy has the giant drill, okay, and he's drilling the woman with this massive drill bit, this huge drill thing, and it's not very subtle. The shot is ridiculous. You could see the drill bit coming from between his legs. It's not subtle at all. And again, De Palma never known for his subtlety. But as they're showing this scene, he's like, yeah, people really complained about it. People really complained about this scene particularly, and they were like, why does the drill bit have to be so big? And in De Palma's mind, his reasoning was, you had to see it come through the floor. That's his reasoning, and he's done. Like, there's, because I think in some in some world, he doesn't even see how insanely, you know, phallic and misogynistic that scene is, because all he was concerned about was the idea of getting that shot of the bloody drill bit coming through the floor. That was his priority. And that's, to me, that says a lot about what this guy and how this guy's mind works. And that's one of the things I loved about this movie, besides all the clips that are so much fun to watch and going down memory lane and seeing all these great movies, besides going back to his student films from the 60s, which was so much fun to watch and see clips from early work of De Niro and Finley and all those guys that he worked with. All that stuff is great, and the behind-the-scenes stories. But there are little tidbits about him. Because, again, you're not going to learn about, like, his life story. It's not like it's not a regular documentary. I mean, they do, oh, yeah, I was born here, I have these brothers, and I did blah, blah. But it's not like a front-to-back documentary about this guy's life. But there are swatches of his experiences in life that are very enlightening and really, really tantalizing and fun as hell. For instance, one of my favorite sequences in the movie is when they show the scene from Dressed to Kill where Keith Gordon is outside Michael Caine's office. And he sets up that camera. And while that scene is happening, De Palma is talking about how he followed his father around, who was a surgeon, followed his father around because he knew he was cheating on his mom, broke into his office with a knife, found the woman he was cheating with, and threatened to kill his dad. And I'm like, oh, my God. And so that right there, that little story, so informs so much of his work. Like, in that one little story, you get an insight into some of the themes that show up in all of his movies. And the movie is jammed with stuff like that, little insights about how he had to protect his brother. There's little things in there that all add up to, I think, an amazing portrait of an unbelievable director. And I also want to mention some of the behind-the-scenes stories are fantastic, and I quickly want to – there's so many of them, I can't go through with all of them. But, Eric, I wanted – because Colin was sitting next to me, so, you know, we talked about it afterwards. Eric, I got to tell you, the stories about Casualty of War, I was on the floor when
Sean Penn whispers and Michael J. Fox.
Oh, my God, you're nothing but a TV actor. Yeah. I was like, oh, my God. And the other thing, the fun about watching that was, like, he was talking about how, you know, like, Sean Penn knocked Michael J. Fox on his butt and they were adversarial because they had to be.
Yeah.
And Sean Penn is very method. And that's one of my favorite De Palma movies, by the way, Casualties of War, one of my all-time favorites. But I love the way that, like, De Palma tells a story and he's cackling. It's like this actor is, like, mistreating Michael J. Fox, calling him a TV actor. And as this story is being told, De Palma is delighted. I don't know. I loved it. I think it's one of the best movies I've seen all year. But again, I am a De Palma fanatic, and I really think in order to enjoy this movie to the fullest extent, you got to be a De Palma fanatic. And clearly Noah Baumbach and Jake Paltrow are. So,
The music box is still going to be showing a lot of De Palma films throughout the week, a lot of them in 35 and 70 millimeter.
Right.
And what's interesting is that on Friday night, you and I, when we saw De Palma, not a huge turnout.
No.
The documentary, but I stayed for Dressed to Kill afterwards, and there was quite a big turnout for that.
So that's interesting. Like nobody's going to see the documentary, but people are going to see the old De Palma movies.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Well, tonight, by the way, at the Music Box, before we break here, is my favorite De Palma movie and one of the best American movies ever made. Blowout is going to be shown tonight. At the Music Box. So if you're going to go see something on the big screen, you should see Blowout. It's and they really do a wonderful job covering it and how much of a disaster it was. And how many of those movies, guys, that De Palma describes as a disaster?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh,
amazing. Okay. All right, you guys, hang on. We got to take a break for the news, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Colin are here, and we'll come back. And we got two mainstream movies, big, big mainstream movies to review after we take a break for the news here on 720 WGN. We'll be right back with that. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. I'm your overnight dude, 2 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell after me at 5, and then the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show, and on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And a little bit later on, it's Monday, so that means my dad will tell a joke. That's coming up with the jokey time. And because yesterday was Father's Day, we are going to talk about the best, the worst, the most memorable TV and movie dads of all time. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We'll get into that a little bit later on. But right now, we're in the middle of the movie reviews. Eric Childress and Colin Suter are here. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right. Eric.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us about Central Intelligence?
Okay, this is a film starring Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart. The movie opens. Both of them are in high school. Kevin Hart is sort of the big star athlete, the most popular kid in school. And Dwayne Johnson is a big fat dork who likes to sing in the school shower and has braces and is constantly humiliated and bullied throughout his high school tenure. One day he has he's thrown onto the gym floor during a pep rally, completely naked and completely humiliated. Kevin Hart's character is the only one that actually kind of pities him and sticks up for him. So flash forward 20 years later. Okay, yeah. Their 20-year reunion that is coming up, and as Kevin Hart's life is not exactly gone the way as most popular kids in school don't see their lives turn out the way they expect. He's just sort of a office drone and whatnot, not getting promoted and whatnot. Then he receives a Facebook friend invite from Dwayne Johnson's Bob character, and they actually get together for some beers before the reunion takes place. And as they start to get to know each other, we find out that Dwayne Johnson is actually in the CIA, and he is now wanted for by his superiors for apparently going rogue in his attempts to catch this notorious bad guy. I don't even remember what he does, but drug dealer, computer hacker, something like that.
He hacked codes for
codes,
right? For missile launches and stuff like that. Yeah.
Wow, so forgettable. But and so it becomes a constant sort of thing. Well, is he the good guy? Is he working on the inside? Is he a bad guy? And it just completely throws Kevin Hart's life into chaos, just hanging with this guy. Okay, so you have a film here that sort of wants to be in the tradition of, films like The In-Laws, but this film was more in the tradition of Bad Company with Chris Rock and Anthony Hopkins, and I don't even know if it lives up to the strengths of that really bad movie. I think this movie is an absolute disaster. I laughed one time in the film, and it's at a joke that is now in the television commercials, so if you can seek that out, you'll see the one laugh in the actual picture. And yeah, I knew this movie was in trouble very early on when, before you even we even get to the CIA stuff that we know is coming, that the chemistry between the two leads just didn't seem to be there. I didn't like any of the choices that Dwayne Johnson was doing, and this is a guy that is almost always a pleasure to see, whether in movies and television. He's such a he just has one of those personalities that just wants to make you smile, and he kept not doing it in this movie. Kevin Hart's once again sort of playing the, you know, starts off playing kind of more of the straight man character, but then just quickly delves right back into his loud screaming voice anytime something crazy happens. I'm okay with a ridiculous plot, just have it be a little interesting or funny. And there's just nothing funny in this entire film. I sat there straight faced and bored throughout a large portion of it. I was even starting to get very drowsy about halfway through. This film is so poorly structured and incompetently put together that I couldn't believe Todd Phillips didn't have his name on it somewhere. I was kind of stunned at how much I dislike this movie. I think it's one of the worst movies of the year.
Wow. Okay. Colin?
I guess I wasn't stunned at how much I didn't like it. I just didn't like it. It's just one of these movies directed with a kind of sledgehammer approach to comedy. Where, you know, louder and crazier equals funnier. And that's just not the case. Certainly not the case here. I think we got two really likable actors kind of stuck in a movie that doesn't give them anything really funny to do. It's weird. With Kevin Hart, he has not been in a great movie. And the one stand-up I've seen of him do, which was that concert film from a couple of years ago, I didn't think was that funny.
It's okay. You got another one coming out in a few months.
Right, but I find him charming. I find him very a likable presence, and I wish he would be in something really good. And this is just kind of one of those movies that, you know, you just kind of forget about on your way out the door, because top of the fact that the characters, like Eric said, don't have that much chemistry, they're stuck in a plot that we are way ahead of, that we just kind of, you know, by the last, you know, half hour or 45 minutes, we're just kind of going through the motions of waiting for the characters to catch up to the audience of, you know, what we know is going to happen. And we know who everybody is, and we know that not every flashback is, you know, to be taken at face value. And it just kind of gets more and more tedious as it goes along. It's an hour and 54 minutes, which is way too long for something like this to sit through. So, not surprised, you know, just looking at the filmmaker's resume, this is the same guy who made Dodgeball and a couple other movies like this, that it turned out this way. But I really wish these two would find a better project for themselves to star in, because this doesn't cut it.
Wow. Okay. I did not hate this movie, and I actually thought there was chemistry between the two of them. And I actually, during the first half hour of this movie, I laughed a lot during the first half hour. I thought Dwayne Johnson was really funny in it. I laughed at the fanny pack stuff. I laughed at, I just thought it was all very, very funny. The first half hour, very, very funny. When the CIA plot thing kicks in, and inexplicably Amy Ryan is in this movie, that's when it becomes okay, you know, and it just gets sillier and sillier. And as you said, you know, Kevin Hart starts out doing the straight man stuff and then eventually just becomes Kevin Hart screaming. And that, as that continues, you know, that, so as the plot continues and it becomes more ridiculous, and you're right, it's way too long. But I still laughed periodically throughout the entire movie, and especially during the first half hour, all the way up until, like, I guess when Amy Ryan shows up. Like, I thought it was funny when Dwayne Johnson came out with the pajamas on. I laughed at that. I laughed at the fact that he's laying on the pullout couch and there's pizza boxes all over the place and 16 candles. I like the 16 candles reference. So I don't know. So I thought they were actually funny together. I don't think the material is very strong. By the time all the big stupid action sequences start and it just becomes loud and crazy, that all that stuff just doesn't work. But there were still periodic moments in the movie where I did laugh all the way through to the end. Is it a great movie? Absolutely not. I don't think it's a terrible movie. I think I think you could do a lot worse than seeing something that's just like a sort of a dumb little throwaway buddy comedy. I don't think it's nearly as bad as you guys think it is. I thought some of the cameos were fun. I won't mention, you know, who's in it, but there are a couple of cameos in the movie that I thought were fun. And I thought there were some big laughs, especially in the first half hour. I thought the first half hour of the movie was really, really funny. Does become increasingly stupid and louder as it goes along. And I'm not, like, saying that everybody should run out and see it, but I think you could do a hell of a lot worse. And I don't know. There were times in this movie where I was very entertained. So,
you know, based on one of the cameos in the film, I mean, we won't say who it is, but considering that he's sort of playing a variation on a role he played in a movie last year,
yeah,
I kept waiting for something really horrible to happen to his wife.
But see, somebody was going to leave a bottle of wine outside the door.
That's right.
Outside the door. All right. Well, I didn't hate it, you guys. I don't know. I thought it was okay. It's dumb, but I laughed. All right. Hold on, guys. We got one more movie to talk about. And it's a little movie. Made a little money over the weekend. We'll talk about that one coming up on WGN, but we got a break here. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. On Monday morning movie reviews continue. Coming up in a little bit, in honor of yesterday being Father's Day, we're going to talk about the best, the worst, the most memorable dads in TV and movie history and all that cool stuff. And speaking of dads, my dad will call in and tell a joke. We are reviewing all the new movies. Colin and Eric join me from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com. We have reviewed Raiders, which was a movie about the making of a fan film. A really fun documentary. All three of us recommend that at the Music Box. De Palma, which is another documentary about Brian De Palma, the filmmaker. All three of us recommended it. I think it's one of the best movies of the year. But we specifically are saying that you kind of have to be a really, really big Brian De Palma fan to thoroughly enjoy it. And then Central Intelligence. Colin and Eric both hated it, and I thought it was okay. Stupid, but kind of funny. Now let's welcome the guys back. Colin, Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, tell us about Finding Dory.
All right. Well, this is the sequel to the big Pixar hit Finding Nemo, and probably the best part of making a sequel to an animated film 13 years after the original is that the characters don't have to age 13 years. And so, in fact, this one almost starts out like a prequel as it flashes back to Dory, you know, Ellen DeGeneres' character, her past, and we meet her parents, who realize they have a difficult kid on their hands because Dory, as everyone will remember, has short-term memory loss. You know, she's been that way since she was, you know, a baby. And she got separated from her parents at a very young age. She remembers that and now wants to find them. But she knows she can't do it alone because, you know, she'll forget things along the way. So Nemo and his dad, Marlin, still voiced by Albert Brooks, help her, and they end up at a marine life institute, which is sort of like Shedd Aquarium. And Dory believes that her parents are in captivity there. And there they meet a host of strange characters, much like in the first one. And the most helpful and significant one is an octopus named Hank, who's voiced by Ed O'Neill. And they run into all kinds of situations, you know, that force them to kind of use whatever means they have to get out of them. This movie it's different from the first, from Finding Nemo, in that it's not just, you know, the fishes are going into the, you know, further into the ocean and meeting a whole weird cast of characters while trying to find this thing or fish. This is, you know, a film that puts these characters in situations that are really hard to get out of. And they really, it's more about the sort of ingenuity that they need to really figure out, you know, these situations. And I think that one of the sort of more creative Pixar movies in terms of just getting into situation and getting out of that situation. This is directed by Andrew Stanton, who did the first film, and he also did WALL-E. He's coming back from making his first live-action film, which was John Carter. This is him more in his element, and I think that this is a really kind of an original. It's a sequel, but it feels like an original in a way, in that it doesn't just repeat all the same story beats of the first film. It's much in the same way, you know, like George Miller approaches a sequel. I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed, you know, watching these characters get into these really complicated situations and watching them figuring out how to get out of them. While also the movie, I think, really still maintains the, you know, the emotional connection with everything, with the audience and with, you know, with the characters. This is a movie that, again, you know, you can tell all the Pixar people are dads now, or, you know, their parents, and, you know, they're sort of dealing with that. And this is a movie about parents who, you know, have to, you know, who are scared about how their kids are going to do later in life when they grow up, if they have something like short-term memory loss. So there, I think there are some really strong emotional moments. So ones that I, you know, I wish kind of lingered a little bit longer. You know, the movie is pretty anxious to get to the next thing, during, you know, the emotional scenes. So I think that's the major flaw of the film. But, other than that, I'm more on board with this movie than a lot of other people are. It feels like, I think everybody says, you know, this is kind of the magic of the first one. I mean, this movie definitely, you know, visually it sort of stays in kind of the murkier waters of the ocean. You know, a lot of underwater stuff is kind of dark and not, you know, not magical, not colorful, but kind of murky. I think that's okay. I'm a big fan of Stanton. I'm a big fan of his visual style, and I still think there's enough visual grandeur in this film to really drink in. And you definitely want to stay till the very end credits. It's a great cookie at the end that calls back, you know, to the first film. It's just wonderful. So I laughed a lot. I smiled a lot. I was moved a lot. You know, it's Finding Nemo is better, yes, but I still think this is a really solid Pixar film.
Okay, Eric, what do you think?
I like the film. I don't think I liked it quite as much as Colin did. I mean, Pixar, obviously the bar is set really high, and you know, even after, you know, we just had Inside Out, which I think we all agreed was, you know,
what's one of the best Pixar movies of all time.
One of the best Pixar movies ever, and certainly a huge return to form.
Yep.
After doing what essentially Finding Dory could have easily become, which is just another lazy kind of cash grab, the way Cars 2 was, and particularly the way Monsters University was, which, I mean, Cars 2 is just a bad sequel to a bad movie. Monsters University was a really lazy sequel to, I think, a great movie.
Yeah.
But this one, I think it's a little more middle of the road Pixar. It's much better than those movies I just mentioned. I think that, as far as emotional stuff in the movie, my favorite scenes in the movie are actually the scenes where Dory is still a child, and we get those moments of her learning to deal with her handicap, and particularly her parents learning to deal with her handicap.
I'm with you 100% on that. That's my it's my favorite stuff in the movie.
Yeah, and I think that if the movie had, I would have been happy if the movie had, you know, like played like a, you know, like, you know, Dory in therapy or something, trying to, you know, remember her past or something like that, rather than, I just kind of disagree with Colin that I think that the movie is, you know, in some ways, you know, reminiscent of the original, and that it's, you know, it plays more like an adventure movie in a way than anything else, and a lot of that is a lot of fun, and there are some really big laughs in the movie. There is some fun action in the movie, and it does have emotional beats. Though I bet the writers at some point, you know, when they're, you know, they realize that, you know, this is what we do, Pixar, you know, we draw emotions out of people and whatnot, and realize that when they're, you know, they're building up to their big sort of crescendo towards the end, that they've in some ways written themselves into a corner, because their primary heroine has short-term memory loss and can't really probably experience the same kind of emotional gratification that the audience might have. So I think that kind of that might lessen it a little bit for her, and maybe even for some other people. But like I said, I mean, these are, you know, more quibbles than, you know, full-out complaints about the movie. I had a good time watching it. It's beautifully animated, as expected. Of course, it's not as good as Finding Nemo. It's not as good as most of the Pixar's, overall. But it's still very entertaining. I would recommend it without question. And I hope people see it.
Okay. And people did.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that later. But we have to break right now for the news.
right here on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Welcome back to the show, everyone. We're wrapping up the movie reviews, and then Eric Childress and I will discuss the box office and talk about all of the big hits at the box office this weekend and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us. That's the best way to stay connected. Coming up in a little bit, my dad will call in and tell a joke. And speaking of dads, yesterday was Father's Day. So we're going to talk about our favorite and the best and the worst and the most memorable TV and movie dads in honor of yesterday being Father's Day. And we're kicking off your work week here on a Monday morning. All right. Eric Childress and Colin Suter are back. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks.
Both recommended Finding Dory. I, too, am recommending it. But like Eric, I have some quibbles about it as well. And I almost agree with you. I agree with you about 100%, almost 100% on this, Eric. Everything that you said about it, I agree with. I did not see it in 3D. Did you guys see it in 3D?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I did that. Now, you were talking about it being murky and underwater and stuff like that. And I was kind of glad that I didn't see it in 3D. How did it play in 3D?
It was fine. I mean, you know, Pixar doesn't specifically make things to be in 3D. I think it's just a gimmick that they kind of have to deal with,
yeah.
You know, after the fact. You know, so it doesn't, you don't need to see it in 3D.
Okay. Well,
it's not really necessary.
All right. I didn't. You know, I loved the early stuff, as you mentioned, Eric. My favorite stuff in the movie involves the young Dory. That's my favorite. That's my favorite stuff in the movie. I also felt that because of the structure of the movie, and you know, you kind of put your finger on it, Eric. And this is what was going through my mind while I was watching it. There is now kind of a structure that has to be a part of every Pixar movie, because they've been known to be they've been known to have these really great emotional moments in the movies. You know, I mean, you think about it. I mean, like, Inside Out, I cried like 10 times during that movie.
Mm-hmm.
WALL-E made me cry. Toy Story 3 made me cry. I don't even want to talk about the first 10 minutes of Up.
Right.
You know, and that's what they've been known for. And the stuff in this movie felt like it was obligated to be there. Do you know what I mean? It didn't feel genuine to me. When they tried to put it in there, it was like, okay, look, this is an adventure movie. We've got a lot of action, some really funny and memorable characters. It moves really fast and a lot of stuff is going on. They got to get into these situations and out of these situations. But, oh yeah, that's right. It's Pixar. So
yeah.
We have to have these emotional moments.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't seem nearly as genuine as they have in other Pixar movies. That,
yeah.
I don't know. That's just the way I felt. Now, not that it's not entertaining, because it is, and not that it's not beautifully animated. Of course it is. And it is a very, very, it's a very entertaining movie. It's hard to talk about the Pixar movies because, as we've talked about before, the bar is so high. Like, they've got so many home runs. Like, Pixar has made so many amazing movies, and they've made, you know, they've made some that I don't think work as well as others. I'm not a real – I'm the only person on the planet who's not a big fan of Ratatouille.
No, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, you know, those sequels that you mentioned, Monsters University is terrible. Both Cars movies are bad. The Dinosaur movie was not very good. So, you know, they're capable, but I don't know. I just don't think this one is quite up to the standards. And, again, Finding Nemo was a great film, a really great film. And it gets to the point where it's unfair. I feel it's unfair to like compare the Pixar movies to other Pixar movies. It's just, especially coming off of last year's movie, you know, I mean, coming off of Inside Out, which is just such an amazing film, which I watched last week again. And it's just, it's extraordinarily fun and really, really emotional and fun. But this is a perfectly serviceable, very entertaining movie that I'm obviously recommending, if not for only because Stringer Bell and McNulty both provide voices.
Only you would bring Pixar Finding Dory down to the wire.
Well, is Stringer Bell is just going to do, like, because he killed in The Jungle Book.
He
was phenomenal. So I love the fact that Stringer Bell is doing some voice work. And I don't know, casting McNulty in this is pretty good, too. So there. Anyway, and again, stay till the end. Oh, my God, stay till the end.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. So, all right. All right, next week, what do we got next week? We talked a little bit about the documentary Tickled, which is coming out next week. What else do we got?
We got a movie, a big budget movie that's not being screened for critics called Independence Day Resurgence.
Yeah, another sequel to a movie that nobody wants 20 years later.
Yeah, and they're not screening it for critics, people.
They're not screening it for critics.
No. but they are screening The Shallows. with the Gossip Girl.
Yeah.
Gossip Girl. And the Free State of Jones with your McConaughey.
Yeah, McConaughey and the Neon Demon is another one.
And the Neon Demon.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, all right, we got all that coming up, and we'll review all those. Colin, thanks, buddy. Yep. We'll talk to you next week, okay?
All right.
Eric, we're going to talk about the box office. Let's do that right now.
Okay.
All right, number one movie in the country is Finding Dory, $136.1 million. That's a record, right?
Yeah, biggest animated opening of all time.
Man, oh, man. Amazing. Now, what was it projected? Like, what did you guess it was going to make?
I thought it was going to do over $400 million. So the opening I had doing around, I thought I was going to do higher than Toy Story 3. So mine was sort of like in the one, originally it was like 115. I said this weekend I told Sergio like 125, 128.
Wow. And he even exceeded that.
Yeah.
Wow. Central Intelligence, $34.5 million. That came in at number two. What's that? Is that considered good?
Yeah, that's pretty solid. It's only budget's only $50 million, that's just pretty much in line with when Kevin Hart's now paired with somebody. That's pretty much what those movies are doing. So that's right on track.
Okay, and what is that looking to end up grossing? What about 100?
It's probably 34.5 million in the summer. It'd be kind of a disappointment if it didn't get to 100. But this summer. There are a lot of movies opening this high that are just not going to make it. So.
Who knows, man? At this point, who knows? Number three, The Conjuring 2 with $15.5 million, bringing his total up to 71. That's still holding up pretty good.
Yeah, big drop-off. It's a horror drop-off. That's kind of what we expect. I thought it was going to hold a little bit better than it actually did. But at $71 million, next weekend, it'll be somewhere around 85, 90. So this one's probably just going to squeak past 100.
Okay. Number four, Now You See Me 2. $9.6 million. That dropped.
Yeah, another big drop. Clearly, it's not going to make its budget back in the U.S., which is $90 million.
That cost $90
million? $90 million. Well, they had to pay Woody Harrelson twice.
Well, there you go. All right.
So this one's probably going to come in somewhere around the $60 million mark. So it's really going to be hoping for some overseas dollars.
Yeah.
For Lionsgate.
All right. Wow. Warcraft. Whoa. $6.5 million total in 2 weeks. $37.7 million. Oh my God.
The third biggest drop in the film in the second weekend that opened on over 3,000 screens.
Man. Oh man. No. But again, the overseas for this thing, like in China, it's killing.
Yeah. Yeah. Doing a whole bunch of business over there. And seriously, if it was doing half the business over there, this would be considered one of the biggest bombs of all time.
Yeah.
So, it's still, right now, still technically one of the biggest bombs of the year. Because the U.S. dollar, this thing might not make it $50 million.
Wow.
In the U.S. That thing drops off so much that it's going to drop off just as much next week.
Yeah. Good Lord. All right, number six, another disappointment, X-Men Apocalypse, which is $5.2 million. Its total is $146 million.
Yeah, one of the lowest grossing X-Men movies in the U.S., but going to end up being the second highest grossing X-Men film worldwide.
And what's the first?
Days of Future Past.
Days of Future Past, okay.
Yeah, no X-Men up until Days of Future Past had grossed $500 million worldwide, which seems odd. But it's absolutely the truth. It's just that they never connected as much as Days of Future Past did, apparently, with the overseas crowd. They were always coming in somewhere around mid-300s. I think a couple of them did low 400s. But this one's almost over $500 million now. So again, it's going to be a small hit for Fox, but it's the film that's probably made them gun shy about screening Independence Day. And Independence Day is a $200 million budgeted film, and according to my records, is the highest budgeted film that's never been screened for critics before.
Wow. Boy, that says a lot.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I guess I'm in the minority because I hated the first one.
I don't think a lot of people have a lot of long, lingering, positive memories. I mean, I think it was one of those movies that was sort of the right time, right when blockbuster things were happening and special effects,
and Will Smith was taking off.
Will Smith was just about to take off. I mean, that was the summer of Twister and Mission Impossible. That was a big special effects type summer.
Right.
But I mean, like, you know, to do a sequel 20 years later. And
I don't know, man. I
you don't even have Will Smith with you, so who cares?
Yeah, I agree. It's going to be interesting to see how this thing does. And then Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Me Before You, Alice Through the Looking Glass, total of $69 million.
Yeah, that's the biggest bomb of the year.
Without question. And then Captain America Civil War, it rounds out the top 10. Okay, next week, what are you looking at being number one?
I think Dory. I think Dory's still going to be number one.
Oh, okay.
If Independence Day is... you know, potentially going, you know, I don't think it's going to tank next weekend, but I'm thinking, you know, maybe, you know, I was originally thinking like mid-50s for it. Because I honestly didn't know how people, did people really ask for the sequel? Are they going to be lining up for it? And I think that now that Dory's got the huge numbers, that it's going to drop just enough to take the number one slot, and Independence Day is going to be second.
Okay.
But yeah, I think The Shallows is going to do surprisingly well.
It looks good, man.
I had a hunch that that's going to be like the little, you know, it's not going to do like, you know, gigantic numbers,
mm-hmm.
but I think it has the potential to do something in like the 50 million range over time.
So like a sleeper hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's a great concept, and I'm excited about it.
Sure. Sharks. So,
yeah. It's sharks, and it's Blake Lively. Come on.
In a bikini.
I'm done. It's enough.
Yes.
All right. All right. Well, Eric, thanks, man. You can check out your box office coverage at movies.com. Tell everybody really quickly where they can see you on TV on Thursday mornings.
Yeah, WYCC-TV, check your Comcast listings. The name of the show is Business First AM.
Mm-hmm.
It's on at 5 in the morning throughout the week, but I'm on every Thursday morning.
Every Thursday morning, okay. All right, Eric, thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, there you go. Eric Childress, everybody.